set your course for the Hoth
Takes podcast.
Welcome back to Hoth Takes. This is episode 5. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Birdwell.
And this is a very special episode of Hoth Takes because we're very pleased to have our very first guest in the history, in the short history of this podcast. I'm so happy to be able to welcome Jamel Bowie, New York Times opinion columnist, to the show because he is one of my favorite writers these days, and it's great to see that he's also a Star Wars fan. So, Jamel, welcome to Hoth Takes.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to have you. We're going to talk today about The Last Jedi because I know that you have quite a number of thoughts about this movie. We did just do our last episode about some of the character development in The Last Jedi, but we've wanted to have you on the show, and we know that you have lots of thoughts about the movie, and so we thought we'd revisit it and chat with you about how you thought it went. So I think, Grace, you want to take it away?
Yes, I do. And before we get formally started, I have to say, Jamel, you have been a key part of my Star Wars journey because part of the reason I decided to watch Star Wars Rebels was because once you tweeted a video of it, like this was 2 years ago or something, and I was like, wow, that looks kind of cool. And then I watched it and it was great. So retroactive thank you for that one.
Oh, you're welcome. To me, that's a shockingly good show. It's like much better than it has any right to be.
Agreed, 100%. But the theme of today's episode is The Last Jedi, the most controversial of the sequels. And what I really wanted to talk about here were some of the underlying themes of the movie, because The Last Jedi is really kind of an idiosyncratic Star Wars movie in that it's a bit darker, it dwells a bit more on failure, and it doesn't go the direction that you're expecting to. And I think in a lot of ways, it is the spiritual successor to Empire Strikes Back in the way that The Force Awakens was to A New Hope. And then Rise of Skywalker was just a mess, but we don't have to talk about that today. But I thought with The Last Jedi, one of my absolute favorite things about it is this idea that it introduces that anyone really can be a hero. Because the whole Skywalker saga, I mean, it's in the name. Like, it's the Skywalker saga. It's about how this one family totally messes up things for billions of people for like 60 years, which is a total bummer. And also, there's this idea that legacy and genetics and whatnot play into your ability to wield the Force and in your ability to be a hero and this destiny that you have laid out. And something that The Last Jedi does that I think is really interesting is it introduces the idea that Rey Nobody, Rey is just some rando who has the Force. Finn is just some rando who was a stormtrooper and now he's becoming a rebel. And the people who are the inheritors of this powerful legacy, like Luke and Kylo, are kind of messing everything up. So all of that is a very long introduction to say that something that I like about this movie is how it introduces the idea of, you know, anyone can be a Force wielder, even this random girl from a desert planet or this random broom boy on Canto Bight. So, Jamel, I'd love to get your thoughts on that idea and how it is explored in The Last Jedi and whether you think it does so effectively.
No, I think you're right on in noting that the movie very much centers on that idea. And I'd go as far as to say that part of the reason why it was so controversial and such divisive is specifically because the movie is an outright repudiation of the idea that there is some sort of destiny tied to one's blood or lineage or what have you. Beyond the characters themselves, there are kind of the major plot points, right? Rey, you know, you as a viewer, you go into the movie thinking that you're going to learn something about Rey's parentage, that Rey is going to have some sort of background that will explain why she's such a powerful Force user. And you learn, I mean, and obviously the next movie kind of unravels this, but The Last Jedi puts forth that, like, Rey's parents were nobody in particular, that she doesn't come from a special background, that she's, you know, what makes her unique, what makes her worthwhile has nothing to do with her lineage and everything to do with herself. You have Luke Skywalker almost repudiating his legacy outright. And you have Yoda sort of saying that maybe the Jedi should die, that maybe there needs to be something new needs to grow out of all of these traditions and legacies that isn't really connected to what the Jedi were. And I think this is, for me at least, this is what makes The Last Jedi such an interesting and unique entry into Star Wars, that it really is, it's both embracing and leaning in to the, I think, the sense of adventure that you get when you're introduced to Luke Skywalker in the first Star Wars movie with the John Williams score and the two sons and all of that. This sense that, you know, a humble, nobody individual can become a hero. But then taking the thing within Star Wars that's always in tension with that, which is that, you know, Luke Skywalker isn't just any farm boy. He is the son of, you know, the Chosen One or something. Taking that and throwing that out and saying that you don't need that. You can just be a nobody. You can just be an anonymous stormtrooper. You can just be some pilot. And it is what you do and that who you are that makes you a hero. I think to just kind of to add more to this, Poe's storyline in the movie is this too, that Star Wars viewers, fans are conditioned to see Poe as someone who's sort of like a natural hero who's always making the right choice, even when it may not seem like it in the moment. And the movie is saying no, that that part of being a hero is knowing when to step back. Part of being part of being a leader is knowing when you have to be collaborative and cooperative. And that Poe's decision to not be those things is a tragedy that ends up harming more than it helps. And it's only when he learns these things that he does, you know, fulfill the what his archetype would suggest that he is. And all of these things I find very interesting and, like, interesting character work that you don't really see from these movies. But it is like a direct attempt to subvert the whole Star Wars paradigm, and people just do not and did not like that very much.
Yeah, I definitely think I'm remembering how when this movie came out in December 2017, and I remember all of these fan theories about, well, who was Rey? Was she a Kenobi? Was she a Skywalker? And then the reviews started pouring in for The Last Jedi, and critics reviewed it pretty highly for a Star Wars movie, which had people pretty pumped. And then a lot of the audience scores ended up being really low because it was, like Jamel said, a direct and deliberate subversion of what you think you know of a Star Wars movie. And that isn't necessarily what people wanted. But I'm interested in getting Haley's perspective here, because Haley is probably the biggest Last Jedi skeptic among us, and I know in particular has problems with Poe's arc here. So, Haley, how do you feel about this theme in The Last Jedi, and do you think it's well represented?
So I think the theme of, you know, anybody can be a hero, I don't have any issues with that. And I think much of the movie was, you know, very well done. And I liked, you know, trying to subvert what people expected. But still, like, there's a way, what I said last episode was, you know, there's a way to do that without, like, intentionally making everyone upset specifically for Poe's plotline. And I mentioned to you two that, you know, you easily could have had the same effect of Poe rethinking how he approaches things, you know, feeling some sort of guilt over the opening sequence where, you know, he goes on this attack and, you know, many of his comrades die. Instead, the entire movie has to be about, you know, Poe's arc anyway has to be about Poe, you know, being a total idiot. And I just didn't really, you know, think that, for instance, the Haldo stuff and the argument that her plan was so much better than his, and like even the people who were supposedly supposed to be doing the right thing, coming up with a good plan, you know, exercising good leadership, they still made a lot of questionable decisions. There could have been much better communication. She didn't notice when, you know, several people on her team were planning a mutiny. It wasn't just Poe who, you know, wasn't inspired, didn't have confidence in her plan. It was, you know, multiple people. So there were things to question there that I think, you know, it could have been done more artfully, in a way that, you know, maybe the audience wouldn't have been so upset. Especially, I think, you know, if he had grappled early on with, you know, the losses from that first scene.
Yeah. And I said, you know, in the last episode that I think a big theme here is, you know, the main characters are wrong a lot of the time. And I don't think Star Wars fans are necessarily used to seeing that. Jamel, would you say that that is part of what makes this movie so subversive, that the characters are stumbling a lot, as opposed to the classic archetype of Star Wars being that they blow up the Death Star at the end and everybody goes home happy?
I think that, having recently rewatched The Empire Strikes Back, I think people forget the extent to which that movie involves the protagonist stumbling around a lot as well and making mistakes. And I think what The Last Jedi does is simply take that element of The Empire Strikes Back and really kind of doubles down on it. And because there's no corresponding sort of like destiny thing to balance that out, to kind of ground viewers a bit more, I think it can be a little disorienting. But then again, I think that's a good thing. Part of, to kind of go big picture, part of what I think the problem with the sequel trilogy was that it did not know what exactly it was, right? That it was not just because of, you know, it's mixed, you know, there are multiple directors, multiple writers across the whole thing. But I'm not sure that at the conceptual stages of planning this thing, anyone really kind of figured out what they were trying to do with three new Star Wars movies. And so one consequence of this is that you have the Abrams movies, which are very much kind of nostalgia trips. And then you have this Rian Johnson movie, which Rian Johnson seems to actually have an idea of what he wants to do with the Star Wars movie. And I sometimes wonder what this would have looked like if Rian Johnson just had all three movies to explore the ideas he wants to explore. But because you have this, you know, kind of deconstruction of a Star Wars movie, I mean, for analogy's sake, it would be as if, you know, the sequel to Star Trek the Motion Picture was Galaxy Quest, right? Like, it's just,
oh wow,
Galaxy Quest is very, has all the DNA of Star Trek, but it's like kind of a deconstruction of Star Trek too. And it works in part because you kind of know that going in, and you know that it's sort of, you know, it's not officially a Star Trek movie. You can kind of go in and that doesn't really bother you so much. But if after Star Trek the Motion Picture there had been this sort of like, again, weird deconstruction of a Star Trek movie that attempts to subvert kind of all of the tropes of the genre and of the property while also being part of the property, I think people would have, like, you know, flipped out. And I think that's sort of the Last Jedi problem, that it's smashed between these two kind of traditional, if muddled, entries. And it has such a specific point of view that it's jarring, that you think you're going to go in for another nostalgia trip and you're coming out with the movie that ends basically on the note that the Skywalkers don't matter, that, you know, the whatever the Force is, isn't tied up in this family, which I think is kind of very powerful and like kind of a daring thing to do, but also disorienting. And the fact that there was no real follow through makes it all the more, you know, weird.
First of all, have to say, love the Galaxy Quest reference, because that's a great movie, great sci-fi movie and send up of Star Trek. But I would agree that when you look at the sequel trilogy as a whole, what I have told Eric and Haley is that for me, it doesn't do the job of convincing me that it should exist. I just see no reason for the sequel trilogy to exist other than Disney saying, hey, so we have Star Wars now, so let's get that bread. And I think you can really see that in the sort of mishmash that is the sequel trilogy, where you have the first and third installments so radically different from the second installment, which does have its own unique vision and is just completely doing its own thing. So I think that, to repeat, I don't think that the sequel trilogy should exist, and it kind of annoys me that it does. But of the three movies, for me personally, The Last Jedi is the most satisfying because it does something that is different. So now I want someone to tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, it's hard to say that you're wrong. I mean, listen, I do love The Force Awakens, but that's in part because I just love Star Wars and I love revisiting it and I love seeing new takes on it. And so I'm not going to sit here and say that I wish it didn't exist. However, I think, you know, you're right, and I think Jamel is right, that The Last Jedi is really the only one that has any idea of what it wants to be and that has a point to make about Star Wars. And it's very weird to go from a movie that, as we've talked about in the past, is quite similar to A New Hope, to a movie that is, you know, has parallels to The Empire Strikes Back thematically, but is trying to send a different message and make a different point. The Empire Strikes Back, there was a message in the core of that was Luke needs to rise up to this occasion and face Darth Vader, and this is about the family. And of course, the most important moment in that movie is a family revelation. But even if Luke can't do it, well, you know, there's another Skywalker. This movie, as much as it does have a lot of that despair and that self-doubt, is, as Jamel said, making a different argument about what Star Wars can be and about who the heroes can be. And so it's extremely jarring to go from one to the other. So I can't say that you're wrong, that this is the only one that is sort of proving its own worth, but I think there's an element of this that is, they're movies. At the end of the day, they're movies. And The Force Awakens was fun to me. We're going to have a separate conversation, obviously, about Rise of Skywalker, but I think there's ways for them to be fun without necessarily rising to the level of raising questions and being thought-provoking in the way that we certainly want movies to be. But I'm just here to defend The Force Awakens, folks. That's just all I'm doing. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Well, I mean, obviously this is a podcast about things that are just movies and that people, including us, take way too seriously. but I think something that Jamel reminded me of in talking about The Empire Strikes Back and The Last Jedi is that Empire Strikes Back it's a bummer. I watched it recently and like a lot of upsetting things happen, and it's not a story of absolute victory. It ends on kind of a bittersweet note, and it ends with failure, and there is failure throughout, particularly with Luke. And something that I want to talk about with y'all is the scene in The Last Jedi where Rey goes into the cave, the dark side cave, and has this weird revelation where she comes face to face with herself. And that's very similar to the Empire Strikes Back scene in the cave on Dagobah, where Luke fights Darth Vader and then he cracks open the helmet, and underneath Darth Vader's helmet is himself. And that's partially symbolism for, hey, you're Darth Vader's kid. But also because, you know, in the end, he's really fighting himself. So, Jamel, what do you think that this movie says about the nature of protagonists, particularly as they fit into the Star Wars world?
It's a good question, and I'm not even sure I have a good answer for it. I think...
I'll take a mediocre answer.
I think that part of the Empire Strikes Back revelation about, you know, Vader being Luke's father, that all of this is tied up in this family, is again to center this traditional hero's journey vision of the protagonist of this kind of dramatic storytelling. And what is interesting about The Last Jedi and about sort of how Rey is positioned is it's again hitting on this point that there isn't necessarily a chosen person, that the hero's journey can be very much about confronting one's own insecurities and one's own fears, without there needing to be any tie to any destiny. I mean, all of this is contrasted within the movie with Kylo Ren, who is very much a person of, you know, special lineage, who I think in a lesser movie would be, you know, the traditional protagonist type, in whose anger and, you know, resentment and venom seems to be tied to the fact that he thinks he is chosen for something and he can't figure out what it is. And that, I mean, to me, that is sort of the dynamic between those two characters. One person who believes they're chosen, one person who wants to be. And again, I think the movie is saying that both of them are wrong, and letting go of this idea of destiny is the only constructive thing to do. And sort of on a metatextual level, is the only direction Star Wars can go if it wants to grow, right? That the only way you can make this an enduring property really is to let go of these old tropes and try to mine for something new. So I mean, sort of aside from the characters in the film, there's also this like metatextual thing with the whole movie, as it relates to Star Wars at large, and what I think the movie is saying about what is a creative dead end and what offers possibilities for real growth. And to the movie's, you know, to the credit of the movie's argument, The Rise of Skywalker, which is kind of like a repudiation of The Last Jedi, ends up being a big creative dead end. And I think this is probably my single most unpopular Star Wars opinion, but I think you can say the same for Rogue One. That for as much of a nostalgia hit as it is for a lot of people, it's kind of a creative dead end. Solo as well. So I think The Last Jedi, in its sort of take on its protagonist and antagonist, is making an astute point about what makes a healthy narrative and how you can actually expand this to go further.
I think that's a great point, especially because, you know, even though Disney and Lucasfilm did allow J.J. Abrams to repudiate Rian Johnson's argument, they end up confirming it when they say, okay, episode 9 is the end of the Skywalker story. We're not going to be following this thread anymore. We're going to be doing more standalone movies, and we're going to give Rian Johnson a trilogy. But we're not going to be focusing on these characters anymore. I mean, I think there is some recognition there to Jamel's point that there's only so much you can do with the idea that this family is very special and they go around either solving or creating the galaxy's problems. And I will say, Jamel, I agree with you about Rogue One. It hits a lot of the right notes for fans in terms of, the space battles and a lot of things feeling authentically Star Wars, but it doesn't, this is the problem with those standalones, is that you're just trying to give fans some cotton candy. You're not trying to take things in a new direction, whether it's a direct prequel like Rogue One, or, an attempt at a character study like Solo. And I do hope that we see Disney acknowledge that ultimately Rian Johnson has a point when he says, the magic of Star Wars can be, Broom Boy. It can be, people make fun of Broom Boy, but I think that moment has a lot of resonance for this franchise, because it speaks to the idea that what our heroes are doing inspires people, and people grow up wanting to be heroes, and they shouldn't, just as in the real world, we tell people, you can be whatever you want to be if you work hard at it. And we have these ideas about you don't need to, we want to build a society where you don't have to come from money to be successful. And ultimately what that's about is saying you should be able to pursue your dreams independent of where you come from and the situation that you find yourself in. And in Star Wars, that is, you see that in Broom Boy, which is he has the Force, but he's not from a special family as far as we know. And the people who are at the forefront of Star Wars, and he runs into a few of them in The Last Jedi, they're making him feel like he can be something. And I think that's just a really great thread for Star Wars to pull on, and I hope that we see more of that in the future.
On that note, I will say, a lot of people who did not enjoy The Last Jedi, and I disagreed with a lot of, what ultimately was included in The Last Jedi. I think some of the things could have been less antagonistic, but while still making, some of these really important points. You can disagree with The Last Jedi, you can, not like it. But I'm still, excited for the Rian Johnson trilogy that he's working on, because I think he, understands the franchise and the universe better than a lot of people. And, he does want to bring some of this, freshness and interesting ideas to it. And I think, maybe a separate trilogy is really going to be a good place for him to do that, where, the sequel to this trilogy maybe wasn't. So I'm excited for that. I think, what you're saying about creatively taking things in a different direction with much more room to grow, I think that's spot on.
This is, a conversation about The Last Jedi, but I think it's worth one thing. It's worth thinking about is why The Mandalorian worked as well as it did. And sort of my take is that rather than try to go the self-referential route, like treating Star Wars as its own genre, which is what I think the sequel trilogy kind of does in total, and that's part of what makes it that's part of what weighs it down so much, that what the Mandalorian does is take one part of kind of the inspiration of Star Wars, the Western, and kind of really drills down on it and kind of returns to the genres out of which Star Wars came. And in a weird way, that ends up giving the whole thing a fresh coat of paint. To the extent that Solo, which is a movie I actually kind of like, I think if it weren't about Han Solo, it would be perfectly fine. But to the extent that Solo is really good, it's in those parts where it kind of just drills down on the particular genre, which is kind of the heist movie, and ignores all the Han Solo continuity detritus. And so I would kind of wonder if Disney, LucasArts, if they're going to draw any lessons from what works about something like The Mandalorian, what works about some of these other properties. And it kind of seems like it, like the Catherine not Catherine Bigelow, Kathleen, no, I'm thinking of the director of Wonder Woman, Patty Jenkins is directing that Rogue Squadron movie. And I wouldn't be shocked if that movie ends up doing something similar to The Mandalorian, which is pulling out an aspect of the materials that make Star Wars, which is the World War II fighter film, and then kind of really drilling down on that with the Star Wars gloss on it. And that could be fun, and that could kind of be a template for the way forward, not so much trying to recapitulate Star Wars, but to really begin to incorporate Star Wars into different kinds of genres and different kinds of stories within the playground.
Some of my favorite Star Wars properties of recent years, like The Mandalorian and like Rebels, they also prove that you can have characters from the original trilogy or the prequels or whatever in your story, and you can incorporate elements of that into the story that you're trying to tell, like Rebels with Ahsoka coming in or with The Mandalorian, spoiler alert, the very prominent Luke cameo, and having that doesn't detract from the freshness of the story because it's not focused on those old characters and old themes, but just having them enhance it. So at least, knock on wood, that's what The Mandalorian is going to continue to do instead of becoming a rehash of old properties now that it's making money. But Haley, you go.
Yes, I was doing some research before this. I was reading your old tweets about The Last Jedi, Jamel.
Oh.
And I wanted to ask you, in 2017, you said that it was, you would rank it third out of all of them. So Empire was your first, A New Hope was your second, and then you had Last Jedi. In 2018, you said it was the second best Star Wars film. So I am curious about your development of that and how, you know, your appreciation for The Last Jedi maybe has grown, you know, since first seeing it.
Sure, this is like a Tim Russert interview. So I kind of wonder, I don't remember what I tweet like after I tweet it, so I have to like get into a headspace, and I kind of wonder if I was like trolling a little bit with that second one. But assuming that I wasn't trolling, assuming that this is a sincere opinion, I would say that part of why A New Hope or Star Wars may have declined a bit is because I think that's a movie whose its age, it's some of its charm, the fact that it's in a lot of ways is very sort of like this very slow-paced 70s hangout film for considerable chunks of time. It's some of its charm, but I think it's also some of its detriment as a movie. It kind of does, you know, I have to actually get into a certain headspace to watch that movie in a way that I don't really have to for any of the other ones. And I think also that Empire, which is my number one Star Wars movie, is just it's better directed. It's visually like just a very striking movie in a way that I don't even think Star Wars, the first Star Wars, is, that it's sort of visually interesting, visually very dynamic. And the Last Jedi, I think, is probably the best looking Star Wars movie, and that's probably why it's gone up in estimation for me. That in addition to all the narrative stuff it's doing, it just looks incredible. Frame to frame, and I don't really think any other Star Wars movie other than Empire has the same level of sort of visual panache. That
it's got some splendor to it. I mean, it dazzles, especially in the Canto Bight stuff.
Right, the Canto Bight stuff, the Holdo maneuver,
so cool,
which I think is just sort of like a really. Yeah, it's very cool. The first time I saw it, I was just sort of blown away because it's a touch of like 2001 in the middle of this movie. The throne room fight is sort of, you know, I recently rewatched Kill Bill Volume 1, and the throne room fight seems to borrow a lot from a scene in that movie where it goes monochromatic with just blue and black as the main colors. And that there are silhouettes of people fighting. It's sort of this very stark, modernist aesthetic. And so just on this like visual level, The Last Jedi is doing stuff that Star Wars movies don't often do, and that really appeals to me quite a bit. So I think that's what would explain it going up in my rankings. Like it's Empire and Jedi are the two that really feel like fully formed, fully fleshed out, like serious movies, and not just kind of like Star Wars properties. And it's funny because I think that's true of, this is going to sound like an insane pedantic distinction, but it's not true of A New Hope, which is the name I kind of use for Star Wars 77 with all of like the post theatrical adjustments thrown in, the special effects, the, all that stuff. But it is true of the theatrical Star Wars, which I think of as just like a different movie than A New Hope, if that makes any sense.
I mean, I think that's a pretty popular position among a lot of Star Wars fans. And like, I promise this is going to sound insulting. It's not insulting. People who were maybe a bit older when the prequels came out, I think that's a common thing I've heard from them, is that Star Wars as it came out, the theatrical release had was very different from the post edits that they made in the 1990s or whatever. But for me, like, I've never seen the theatrical release of Star Wars, so I don't really have the same frame of reference to compare it to. And I know I could probably find it in a totally legal way.
Yeah, I watched it in a very legal way, definitely.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
It's wild. There's a dude who's just like a big dude instead of Jabba the Hutt. It's just a dude
with
a bear skin, like,
it was a cute little outfit he
on.
Had.
Yeah, he has like a Scottish accent too. It's great. It's so weird. I mean, the thing about that the theatrical version, it's a very strange movie, and that's what I think has all these rough edges, which provide a lot of its charm, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I will say, we did. You're talking to people, Jamel, who did an entire episode about the redeeming qualities of Attack of the Clones. So we have been known to look for the bright side in Star Wars and the positive aspects where we can find it. And by the way, speaking of Attack of the Clones, if you enjoyed the Holdo maneuver with the striking, visual thing, and then the audio cuts back in.
Yeah.
The Star Wars did that in the Geonosis chase before the Holdo maneuver. So a little plug there for Attack of the Clones, everybody. Just gotta get that in there. Yeah, the peak of Star Wars. I think that's true in a lot of ways, that the Star Wars can be at its best when it's challenging the preconceptions of people who come in who want a certain thing. And it's ironic that, Disney sort of, I think we talked about this in our last episode, that they almost recoiled from each sequel movie with the next sequel movie.
Each one is an answer to the first.
Right. And fans didn't necessarily love the nostalgia of The Force Awakens, or at least some fans didn't. And so then Rian Johnson had the green light to take it in a new direction, and there was sort of a course correction after that. But it's almost like Disney learned the wrong lesson from that, and especially from The Last Jedi backlash in general. And I hope, as we've talked about, I hope that they learn the right lesson with the new properties, which is, people who didn't like the challenging aspects of The Last Jedi are not necessarily the fans that you want to cater to with future projects, because if you cater to them, you're just going to have increasingly rehashed versions of The Force Awakens. It's sort of like when you copy a file over and over again. You're just going to end up sanding off all the edges until you have something that, maybe it tests well, but it's not innovating.
I would also say you can't write movie by committee. And I think that's like the trap that they fell into with a lot of this, is, debating which fans to disappoint. And, if they had honestly, if they had done just J.J. Abrams for all of it or just Rian Johnson for all of it, like, I think a lot of people would be a lot happier with how it turned out versus, you know, this sort of disjointed thing that it ended up being.
I think that there's a larger conversation to be had in terms of Star Wars, but also just in fandom in general, about which fans get listened to, which fans have the loudest voices that are the most heard by the studios. I mean, I think the whole release the Snyder Cut is a really good example of which fans get listened to. And funnily enough, they are typically male, often white, and very, very loud on the internet. So I think there is a larger discussion to be had about those fans and the role that they've had traditionally in the development of Star Wars, particularly as it pertains to the sequel series. But I would agree that there was too much trying to respond to fan backlash, because even The Force Awakens itself was a repudiation of the prequels, because at that point in 2015, it was still pretty popular to bash the prequels.
I mean, the whole production process was, look at how many physical sets we're building.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the problems, as you mentioned, Haley, is that each film exists to repudiate the previous film, and that's not really sustainable or conducive to forming a cohesive and coherent trilogy. I'm interested in knowing, since we have Jamel's opinion now on ranking of The Last Jedi, where Eric and Haley, you would put it, because I think, like, I also am slightly being trollish, but slightly not, when I say that The Last Jedi is my second favorite behind Empire. It's similarly because of the reasons Jamel mentioned about the stunning visuals and the darkness of it and its willingness to kind of be weird. So I'd be interested in hearing where you two put it.
I have conducted a quick Twitter search for my old ranking. And clearly I was very unhappy with The Last Jedi because I had it third to last above Attack of the Clones. Believe it or not, I had Attack of the Clones before The Phantom Menace. I think I would have a different ranking. I enjoyed Last Jedi more when I watched it again recently, knowing that I was going to be disappointed by some parts of it. So I don't have a definitive answer for you yet. I'd have to think through the other ones.
Yeah, I also just did a quick Twitter search, and I don't know that I've ever actually tweeted out my rankings. And partly I think it varies based on when I've last seen various movies. I feel pretty confident in saying that Rise of Skywalker would be at the bottom, at the very least, you know, second to last, if not last. You know, it's hard. I mean, to me, there are things that I like about all of them, in part because I'm one of those nerds who has read, you know, the tie-in fiction and all that. And so when I watch the movies, there are things that jump out to me as enriching other parts of the franchise that I like. And so it's hard for me to sort of convert my likings of my appreciation for those different movies into like a score. I would say that, you know, The Last Jedi is in the top half, just because it, and part of this is, as Jamel pointed out, it's metatextual, right? I like the fact that it is challenging what Star Wars has been and trying to point the way forward for Disney. And so I just, on a meta level, I appreciate that it went to that length to make that point. We talked about last week, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that is unfortunate. The timing of when it starts, the Canto Bite sequence, you know, we said that we liked the production design, but story-wise, it's not necessarily, it doesn't serve the movie super well. So that holds it back in my view, but there's no denying that it is a marker of, you know, the future of Star Wars, if only they can bring in people like Rian Johnson to sort of make those decisions.
Jamel, one last thing I wanted to ask you about was the Canto Bite sequence, because I too creeped upon your previous Last Jedi tweets, and saw that although you appear to be a fan of the movie, you are not a fan of the Canto Bight sequence. So I just wanted to hear a little bit more from you about why not, and after a couple of years, if your perspective on that has changed at all, or if you're still anti-Canto Bight.
Yeah, I think that the problem with the Canto Bight sequence is more, I think, execution than it's what it's trying to do conceptually. It's very clear that what it's trying to do conceptually is add some moral ambiguity to the whole Star Wars thing. And to note that, you know, that there's war profiteers in the Star Wars universe. There are people who are making money off of all of the endless conflict, and that they somehow escape the scrutiny of our heroes. The problem, and it's supposed to give Rose a bit more character development, it's supposed to give Finn some more character development, and give those two characters something to do while the rest of the cast and the rest of the characters are with the ship, or with, you know, Rey's thing with Luke. But it just sort of it's like a pretty abrupt break from what, from kind of the style and tone of the rest of the movie. It's like this weird flashback to, I mean, specifically Attack of the Clones, the whole like diner, you know, that whole chase sequence to Coruscant, to me is what Canto Bight feels like the most. And that's sort of my, it's like, it's, I think it's a good idea that just like isn't fleshed out enough and sort of needs more, it basically needs like 10 more minutes, really, to integrate with the rest of the story and do what I think they want it to do. Yeah, that's my take. I think that's my take on it. Like I think you could remove it from the movie and the movie would be fine. You would just have two characters who just really had nothing to do for the whole film, which I think is a bit of a problem. But if you're going to have Oh, go ahead. Sorry, please.
Go ahead. Well, I just wanted to ask you what you thought of, like, how the movie set up Finn. You know, what I was hoping for in the first one, The Force Awakens, was Finn would be Force sensitive, and sort of we would get to watch his character grow into that. And, you know, that it sort of, to me, handicapped the development of that character in this one, where he's sort of, as you said, sort of stuck, you know, they had to have something to do with that character. Well, all the rest of the movie is going on. So I'm just curious what you think of, you know, how the movie sort of left things with Finn, and if you think that could have been any better, or, you know, what you think of that.
I mean, I think how Finn was handled through the entire trilogy is kind of a big weakness of it. I mean, this gets to something that I said earlier, which is that these movies don't really know, and on the whole, what they're trying to do. And I think that goes to the character level as well. So I'm not sure that there was any, I mean, there might have been some sort of character Bible, right? Like, it's entirely possible that they had some kind of grand outline. But I have a feeling that they didn't really know what they were trying to do with Finn. And The Last Jedi, in which it seems like they're trying to, the Canto Bight sequence is both trying to make him, or impress upon him, the need for heroism, and also maybe kind of connect his being a child taken away to be a stormtrooper to these to other children and, you know, disadvantaged people in the Star Wars universe being exploited. I think it's a fine tact to take that ends up being wasted because The Rise of Skywalker doesn't really do much with Finn either. But had the sequence had like a little more space to breathe and a little more time to develop those things, and been a little better integrated. I mean, part of the issue, right, is that it's just sort of like, oh, we're going to Canto Bight, and you're like, you're going to where? I think if the movie had not. There's a bunch of story development things I probably would not have done, like start it immediately after the previous movie. Like putting some space in the timeline between the two movies may have helped a lot, as it did with the original trilogy. Like, just putting space in between and creating the impression of character growth does a lot for those movies. But to answer your question, I think The Last Jedi, like, none of the movies do well by Finn, I think. The Last Jedi doesn't do the worst by Finn, and it attempts to do something with him that I'm not sure it entirely succeeds at. But, you know, obviously the one that does the worst by Finn is The Rise of Skywalker, which just if I were John Boyega, I'd be very upset about that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, same. I think if there's one thing that we've found, and we have a lot of disagreements, the three of us, but there's one thing that we all agree on, and that is that Finn and John Boyega did not get the treatment that they deserved over the course of three movies, and that was a real weakness of the series, and ultimately, I think, a loss for Disney that they missed out on having a really good, well-developed character, particularly since John Boyega is just such a charming actor, that they, if they had chosen to do something with him, they really could have done something great. One more thing I will point out that is completely irrelevant to everyone but me and possibly two other people who listen to this podcast, one of those other people being my mom, is that the guy who does the cameo of the hacker with the red rose carnation flower pin is Justin Theroux, who plays the main character in the critically acclaimed and tragically underseen show The Leftovers. So shout out to my other two Leftovers fans out there who appreciated that split second of seeing him in Canto Bight. We exist and we have rights.
That's also a great example of, like, you're gonna get Justin Theroux. Like, I feel the same way about Benicio del Toro, where it's like, he, like, you could have done more with him. Like, that, you know, I have not seen The Leftovers, but I know that a lot of people were kind of frustrated that they got Justin Theroux for literally a 5-second role. So they could have done more there. One thing I will say, you know, Jamel raised the point of a character Bible. I think the problem with this trilogy, and I hope that this is addressed with Star Wars going forward, is that unlike Marvel, there is no firm guiding hand for the filmmakers. And this is a controversial issue. We should probably do a whole separate episode on this. But, you know, Lucasfilm has like a story group, but those people are really more there to sort of give advice to writers who want to explore something. Okay, what have we already said about this in Star Wars? Can I have this kind of ship? Okay, well, no, you can't have that kind of ship, but you can have this kind of ship. There's no story guidance that is ensuring that three different directors will produce a cohesive story, whereas Marvel has, you know, Kevin Feige and other people who are well-versed in the comics who are able to ensure that multiple directors in the MCU can create something that feels relatively stable. There are definitely some uneven movies, and you know, to our earlier conversation about different themes, the MCU has, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, and then it has, you know, Captain America. I mean, they pursue a lot of different angles of what the Avengers can be. I don't think that Star Wars has that, and I think that Lucasfilm has suffered because the story group is not willing to do that. They want to advertise themselves as anybody can come in and write or direct a Star Wars movie, and you're not going to have us looking over your shoulder and telling you that you need to write this kind of story. We're going to be making much more minute suggestions to you. I would argue that that has actually not served Star Wars well, and I feel kind of bad dropping this at the end of an episode, but I would love to know briefly if other people agree that The Last Jedi is kind of an indicator of that problem.
I think that's kind of the role that Dave Filoni has played, particularly for The Mandalorian, is being that kind of Star Wars guy who is deep in the lore and was able to support Jon Favreau in the development of The Mandalorian. But, I mean, it's hard because I think after the prequels, there was a lot of backlash against the guy who created Star Wars, George Lucas. I mean, fairly, because the prequels are extremely problematic in many, many ways, although I love them. So I think there's kind of no real expert anymore. There's no, like, there's nothing to start from other than that very first movie in 1977 and everything that came thereafter. So I think it's a lot harder than the MCU, where they have 70 years of comics to build on.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the MCU is that Kevin Feige, or Feige, I actually have no idea how you say his name.
I think it's Feige.
Is it Feige? Kevin Feige is sort of like the, is the maestro for the story beats for the franchise, but there isn't, it's sort of like, there's like this illusion of narrative cohesion in the MCU that works really well, that you can actually watch a lot of these movies and not really know much about the previous movies, but if you do know, then you see all the little connections and it works pretty well. I think Star Wars needs a little bit of that, but not for the main films. I sort of think that for the main films, for the sequel trilogy, they should have gone in a very director-driven, in a director-focused manner. They should have found one person who has an idea of what they want to do with a Star Wars sequel trilogy and just let them go at it for three movies with, you know, whatever, you know, oversight and such is needed. And then if they want to do spinoffs, that's the opportunity to have a kind of Kevin Feige type, Dave Filoni, guide specific directors to having sort of some sort of common unified narrative that fits together. But I think the sequel trilogy, I mean, I think the problem with the sequel trilogy is basically that too much of it was by committee, as Haley said. And that it needed to be like, in the same way that the other movies are for good and bad, George Lucas, this needed to be for good or bad, someone with a singular vision of what they wanted to do. And I mean, my take on this is it should have been Ryan. Like, Ryan Johnson very obviously has, like, a theory of Star Wars. And so we'll just, like, let him do it. Give him, you know, the $500 million you need to make three of these movies and see what happens. But I think Disney was just very risk averse in this, and it seems to me that so much of the problems with Star Wars, Disney Star Wars, is tied to the risk aversion of the corporate parent with regard to this massive property, which is unfortunate.
I would completely agree with that. I think Disney has a great property on its hands with the potential for some really great things, but that risk aversion is definitely problematic and one of its biggest downfalls, I think, in the sequel trilogy. I think that's a good place to wrap up. So thank you very much to Jamel Bowie. This has been a very fun conversation. And I look forward to arguing with you on Twitter about Rogue One in the future.
It's not a good movie, people, I will say.
And Jamel, if people do want to find your work or argue with you on Twitter in a respectful manner, yes, I will say respectful manner, where can they find you?
On Twitter, I'm just at jbouie, J-B-O-U-I-E. My column is in the New York Times on Tuesdays and Fridays.
It's very good.
I'm also, thank you. I'm also on Instagram, and that's also just at J-B-O-U-I-E, jbouie.
And when is your New York Times column going to talk about Star Wars? I think all of our listeners are waiting for that.
You know, maybe I wrote a column about Watchmen, so if I find some inspiration about Star Wars, I will certainly write a column about Star Wars.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. It's been great having you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is a real pleasure.
And thank you so much, our listeners, for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest future topics for shows, you can email us at hothcakes@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @hothcakes. I'm at Grace_Seegers on Twitter. Eric is at Eric Geller, and Haley is at Burdenator. Haley made our incredible logo and banner art. I edited the show, and Eric put together our wonderful music. Although for legal purposes, we should note that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, hottakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, share it with a friend. And if you don't like the show, share it with an enemy. Just tell them to subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. Thank you again to our wonderful guest star, Jamel Bowie, for chatting with us. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.